May it please the court, Timothy Storm on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Scavenger Sale Limited Partnership. This is an appeal of the District Court's final order declining to enter judgment against the defendant, Tony Bryant, as provided in a settlement agreement between the parties. The operative facts are very simple. The parties entered into a settlement agreement in April 2000 to terminate litigation in the District Court. The settlement agreement provided that the case would be dismissed without prejudice pursuant to the settlement. In fact, the District Court dismissed the case with prejudice. The settlement agreement also provided that the parties agreed to a judgment in the amount of $1.6 million against Mr. Bryant, but if Mr. Bryant paid either a substantially reduced lump sum amount or a reduced amount over time, the $1,600,000 judgment would not be entered. Mr. Bryant did not pay either the lump sum or the time payments, and as a result, Scavenger Sale was entitled to entry of the $1,600,000 judgment. However, the District Court declined to do so, finding, in accordance with Mr. Bryant's argument and relying primarily on the Checkers case, that the agreed amount constituted an unenforceable penalty against Mr. Bryant. The District Court essentially held that because Mr. Bryant began to make payments under the time payment option, the only available outcome to Scavenger Sale thereafter was the payments due under that option, even though that's not what the parties agreed to in the settlement. In this case, Mr. Bryant did unambiguously agree to entry of a judgment in the amount of $1,600,000.
How do we know whether that was a penalty clause? I mean, presumably there are, in all of these cases, there are two ends of the telescope you can look at. Either the $1 million time payments was a discount and $1.6 million is the real amount, or the $1 million time payments was the real amount and $1.6 million is the penalty. How do we decide between those two characterizations of the same thing?
By looking at the parties' agreements in the first place. In this case, the parties' agreement unambiguously...
By looking at the parties' agreement, but every contract with a penalty clause in it reflects the parties' agreement.
Correct.
Otherwise, it's not a contract. So that can't be the right answer. What's your next answer?
I'm going to persist with that answer for a moment, if I may, Your Honor, because you have to look at the structure of the parties' agreement. In this case, it was a $1.6 million judgment. It was unambiguously agreed that that was the amount that Mr. Bryant owed on the underlying loan agreement.
It's fine, right? Bassanio agrees that if he doesn't repay the loan, he'll give Shylock a pound of flesh. Right? That's a penalty clause, but it completely reflects the party's agreement.
That's distinguished, Your Honor, from Checkers, where the agreement clearly was, in essence, the lower amount. The higher amount was clearly nothing other than a penalty for failure to pay the lower amount. In this case, the higher amount is tied directly to the amount that Mr. Bryant owed and agreed that he owed on the underlying obligation.
Yeah, but that's a different observation. The amount he owed on the underlying obligation. How do we know the amount he owed on the underlying obligation?
Mr. Bryant told us that was the thing
that was about to be tried and which was... the settlement prevented from being tried.
Mr. Bryant told us what the amount due under the underlying obligation was. The settlement agreement clearly sets forth that it's $1,600,000.
I think if we're going to resolve the penalty versus discount, we've got to look outside the settlement agreement. If we look outside the settlement agreement, what do we find?
We find only one thing outside the settlement agreement between these parties, Your Honor, and that's the underlying loan agreement itself. The underlying loan agreement...
And what did it provide?
On the underlying loan agreement, the court had already entered summary judgment in favor of Scavenger Sale on the liability aspect. All that remained then was a prove-up of damages. That, as the court just observed, was unnecessary because the parties stipulated to a $1.6 million amount. Now, granted, it was $1.6 million at 15% interest, as opposed to the 40% interest provided in the loan agreement, but it was nonetheless the clearly expressed, unambiguous agreement of the parties as to the amount due. Mr. Bryant could avoid that amount due if and only if he met certain qualifications of paying a reduced amount. no one doubts that he did not meet those obligations.
So under your theory, if Bryant had paid, let's say, $800,000 or even $899,999, he would still owe your client $1.6 million?
That's not exactly correct, Your Honor. He would still be obligated on a $1.6 million judgment that he could certainly show as a set-off amounts that he had paid after the judgment or after the settlement agreement had been entered into. So the issue here is not strictly the amount that he owes. The issue here is how much the judgment should it have been. Should it have been what the parties agreed to, or should it have been some lower amount because Mr. Bryant went part of the way down a payment road, but not all the way down
that
road?
Did you ever suggest to the district court the option that if it thought there was some problem in the settlement agreement, the entire settlement agreement should be set aside and the a proper judgment entered on the merits of the case?
We did not do that, Your Honor, because we were stuck in sort of a catch-22 situation as a result of the district court having dismissed the case with prejudice rather than without prejudice. As the court recalls from the record, the parties had agreed to a settlement without prejudice, which would have allowed us to go back in and reopen the underlying case, which would also have led to a $1,600,000 judgment. The court instead chose a dismissal with prejudice, and at the time of that occurred, it didn't appear that there was any difference in outcome between a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice, because the district court assured counsel directly and repeatedly that in the event Mr. Bryant didn't fulfill one of the time payment options, we could come in and get the $1,600,000 judgment entered. As it turned out, that did not occur, of course. Now let me return for a moment, if I may, to the basic issue of Checkers, in which this court applied penalty jurisprudence to settlement agreements. In doing so, it relied on the South Suburban Housing Center case, and we've put forth in our brief in a variety of ways our view that the South Suburban case may have been read rather broadly in Checkers so as to not support the outcome of Checkers.
Has any Illinois case indicated disagreement with Checkers?
No Illinois case has indicated disagreement with Checkers, but no Illinois case has indicated agreement with Checkers, and those state
courts... All the more reason for us not to fuss with it.
However, those state courts that have addressed the issue, including the Court of Appeals of Colorado and the Court of Appeals of Florida, that have addressed just this issue, have found that that penalty jurisprudence would not apply to void the $1,600,000 judgment, as in this case. I see that my initial time is up. If there are no further questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Storm. Mr. Borsia.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Jim Borsch. I represent Robert Bryant in this matter. The issue in this case is, I think, rather simple, and that is, can the court enforce the provision on which counsel is relying on for this $1.6 million, what he calls, judgment? This involves a...
I have fundamentally the same question for you I had for Mr. Storm, which is, how do we tell whether the $1.6 million is a penalty or the $1 million option is a discount?
Well, and with all due respect, I think I agree with Mr. Storm. You have to look at the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement in this case did not involve a $1.6 million judgment. It involved an alternative payment plan whereby
the settlement agreement recites that at the time of the settlement, the amount owing on the note was $1.6 million.
Correct.
And if that recitation is true, the $1.6 million can't possibly be a penalty. It's just the amount that the plaintiff would have gotten had the case gone to judgment.
I disagree with that. And the reason is because the plaintiff didn't agree to accept $1.6 million. As a compromise, as a settlement, the parties agreed to the $1,030,000 payment plan.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the plaintiff, on top of that, asked for $1.6 million in a penalty stipulation, because the question you posed to counsel was, how do we tell it's a penalty? Illinois courts have a test for determining whether or not a provision is a penalty. It does the amount reasonably approximate what the damage is or what the loss would be,
right,
if it is not met.
And if your client agreed in this document that the amount of the judgment had case gone, been completed, would have been $1.6 million, which your client appears to have agreed, then $1.6 million can't possibly be a penalty. It is the party's estimate of the judgment.
But that's the case in all these cases, that, of course, there's an agreement by both sides that that amount will be paid. The test is the excess amount a reasonable approximation of what the plaintiff's damages would be? In this case...
Now, what makes you think that scavenger sale investors would have gotten less than $1.6 million had the damages trial been held?
Well, there were defenses put up in the case.
The defenses had already been rejected.
Well,
we are now in a position of going, getting a, basically the damages prove up.
Correct.
Right, and this is a suit on a note, so one would think the damages on a note are pretty easily calculable. What was the amount owing on the note?
I think it was approximately $1.6 million as the agreement
okay.
reflected.
Well,
and my client had paid $2.7 million up to that point in time. Based upon the interest.
That's what happens
upon.
When you've got interest. Everybody knows you buy a house, you end up paying with interest a lot more than the purchase price of the house.
But nothing would have stopped my client from appealing the summary judgment order. This litigation could have gone on and cost both sides for some time, and my client could have prevailed on appeal. The plaintiff agreed to accept the $1.3 million amount as a compromise. Both sides agreed to that. The reason it's a penalty and it's not enforceable is that agreement, the provision that he's relying on, does not allow for any offset for amounts that have been paid. Counsel is now trying to...
You heard your adversary's answer, and that seemed a straightforward one. Provides for a $1.6 million judgment, but then, of course, you get credit against the judgment for whatever you've paid.
But the way the agreement is drafted, it states that they're entitled to $1.6 million judgment regardless of what amounts have been paid.
Exactly. That's always the way litigation works. You get a judgment for the amount that's due, and then the opposite side gets credit for all amounts paid.
I think there could have been an argument at that point in time that the amount of $1.6 million was on top of the amounts that had already been paid. That's how Judge General felt the agreement was drafted. And also, there's a provision in the contract that provides for interest. The interest amount is easily calculable based upon what amount is left outstanding. This agreement does not differ in terms of whether a payment is one day late, the last payment, or whether no payments are made.
That's a perfectly normal provision in a loan agreement, as you know. The reason I'm asking these questions is that this has a sense of deja vu. It's the civil equivalent to the criminal defendant's argument when he refused to plead guilty and therefore gets 30 years in prison. That's a penalty for his insisting on going to trial, whereas if he had pleaded guilty and gotten the reduction, he could have had only 10 years in prison. And that 20-year difference is a penalty, and we know constitutional rights can't be penalized. And courts always reject that argument because they say the benchmark is what would have happened had you gone to trial, been convicted, been sentenced in the ordinary way. Right, and anything other than that is a discount. And here it looks like you are making the argument, and the district court bought the argument, that the criminal defendant always makes, that the amount measured by what would have happened after a trial is a penalty.
And my submission is that's the same event as in Checkers, the same argument, and the same argument in all these cases, is that you can't look at it in terms of what would someone do based upon prior to the fact. You have to look at it in terms of what was reasonable at that time.
We have large numbers of people in prison today based on the proposition that what they get when they go to trial is not a penalty for the exercise of their constitutional rights.
But Illinois law is clear. Courts will not enforce penalties. It's against public policy.
Right, but that's the holding in these criminal cases, that it is not a penalty. That once you figure out, in order to figure out whether something is a penalty, you figure out what would have happened had the case proceeded to judgment. That's not a penalty. Right. So if this agreement provided for more than what scavenger sale investors could have gotten had the case proceeded to judgment, that would be a penalty. If all it provides is exactly what they get if it proceeds to judgment, then it's not a penalty.
And that's
where I'm coming from.
I think the response is that we don't know what would have happened had the case gone to trial.
Well,
you never know that
problem.
When you settle the case. Is there are defenses that were raised. Summary judgment was entered, but that doesn't mean those couldn't have been prevailed upon on appeal. And the plaintiff agreed to the compromise. The compromise was $1,030,000. And the fact that the plaintiff on top of that asked for $1.6 million without any estimate.
That, of course, is part of the problem. I mean, your view is that if a case settles and the settling party doesn't pay, it can't be resurrected and the full judgment entered because that would be a penalty.
Well, I think the plaintiff here had an option. He could have asked for the dismissal to be without prejudice. And with all due respect, the judge did not force him to dismiss this case with prejudice. The record shows he chose to dismiss the case with prejudice pursuant to the settlement agreement. He could have decided he's going to withdraw the settlement because there was not full performance and proceed to judgment, in which case we would have known what would have happened had the case gone to trial. But in this case, both sides agreed to the settlement. The compromise is a contract under Illinois law, and if it has a penalty provision in it, the court can't enforce the penalty provision. And I think that's the crux of the issue is you have to look at it in terms of when that was drafted. Was there a reasonable approximation of what the damages would have been? And the fact that the agreement does not have any differentiation.
The agreement recites that $1.6 million is what the damages would have been. It's your client's agreement that that's what the damages would have been had the case, had the trial finished.
No, the agreement was that's what was owed at that point in time, but obviously the client was not waiving. Defenses had already been raised at that point in time. The court had entered summary judgment, but that would not have stopped those defenses from being continue to be pressed, even on appeal if that became necessary. We've also raised the issue of waiver in our brief, and I won't take much time on that, but it's unnecessary in our mind given the issue of the penalty being enforced or not being enforced reduces or gets away with any issue of a waiver because it's a non-issue at that point in time. The district court found that the provision was not enforceable at the beginning, and the rest of the agreement is enforceable because the agreement did have a clause that said if one part of the contract is not enforceable, the remainder of the contract will remain in force. In this case, the plaintiff accepted the $1,030,000 payments, and the court tacked on to that additional interest to make up for the amount of time that was lost given the time value of money, which was calculated pursuant to the contract. I think I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Borsa. Anything further, Mr. Storm?
Very briefly, Your Honor, the argument that's being made here by the appellee is a rather empty and ultimately rather dangerous one because it is undeniable from the record that $1.6 million was the amount owed. The fact that my client indulged Mr. Bryant and gave him the opportunity to avoid that $1,600,000 creating a lowered amount should not permit Mr. Bryant to then use that forbearance as a lever to come in and say that the amount that undeniably was owed is a penalty. Only because my client exercised goodwill, exercised forbearance, and so forth are we standing here today talking about a penalty. The $1,600,000 is a penalty with reference to nothing, but the argument comes up that it's a penalty only with reference to a lowered amount, a forbearance, a settlement. And if that type of argument is accepted, it leads to the conclusion that no one would risk forbearing from an amount owed. You have to push forward, get as much as you can, and not engage in a settlement because if you do, you run the risk of losing what you're entitled to in the first instance. That's the result that we have if we follow the district court's ruling.
You can solve this problem by drafting in such a way that if you pay as agreed, then the case is dismissed, but otherwise the case is reinstated.
Well, that's the way the thing was drafted in the first instance in this case. It didn't work out that way, and it's hard to imagine how something could have been drafted to more clearly reflect the party's intentions in the event the time payments were not made than in this case. If it didn't work in this case, it's hard to believe it could work in any case.
What about counsel's statement that you agreed to the dismissal with prejudice? Didn't you have the option to reject the judge's suggestion?
Oh, I suppose I have the option to say I reject that suggestion, Your Honor. What the outcome would have been is another question, but I welcome scrutiny.
Well, the outcome would have been a dismissal without prejudice. I mean, the court couldn't force the dismissal with prejudice on you, could it?
I, w- I don't know that it could or couldn't. It's up to the court to end of the order, but I welcome scrutiny of that part of the record because it's very clear what the district court said it would do in the event of nonpayment, and that didn't happen here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.